I was attracted to playing in front of big crowds, big moments, big pressure. I went one day from being James Haskell, 120 kgs, England player, to James Haskell. I probably hadn't really addressed any of the stuff that I needed to.
Yes, welcome everyone back inside the More Than A Name studio. And this week we are joined by the one and only James Haskell, a true titan of English rugby. I wrote this, James.
I know you did, yeah. It sounds like I paid you to do it as well, yeah.
77 caps for the England national team. He made his debut in 2007. He's played in multiple World Cups, represented the prestigious British and Irish Lions. If you're watching, the shirt is behind. Won a Premiership title and a Heineken Cup with London Wasps, and is a former Grand Slam winner in Six Nations as well. He's also played in France, Japan, New Zealand, and since hanging up his boots, he's become a DJ, a best-selling author, and even made it to the last two of a Heinz baked bean advert.
Yeah, I did.
James, where do you want to start today?
Well, I won Celebrity Mastermind, specialist topic, Harry Potter, so let's not forget. If we're going to list all of them, let's get that out there right away.
Toughest question?
It was one, I think, about when Ron eats the chocolates, he's got the love potion in and falls in love. It was who had spiked him. And I think I got it wrong. I don't know if it was Rowena Love. Rowena somebody. I can't remember. But I messed it up. As is evidence, I can't say the answer now. So I was good. I got all of them right apart from one. And I my general knowledge was all right. And it was amazing when we took Homage to Jarley, the amazing comedian I was a massive fan of. I was like trying to take it fun and like easy and like not go turbo. Because I had Charlotte Crosby, who chose her special subject, whales and dolphins. Obviously, someone had explained to her that, A, whales and dolphins is a huge category. Yeah. Dolphins alone would be mental. Whales and dolphins. And the fact you've got to learn all the Latin names. And when she told me, I was like, oh, okay, good luck. So she didn't do quite as well. But Omid, as he came off, he was like, beat that. And I was like, oh okay, we're going turbo, are we? So I ultimately did that. Yeah, so that's my one crowning glory, really, which shows that I'm not quite as big a meathead as I thought I was, but my specialist subject was Harry Potter, so it sort of slightly diminishes my intelligence.
Did you watch Harry Potter before any big games that calm you down?
No, do you know what I used to watch before games? So the first part of my career, because I worked very heavily with a therapist from like 17 to kind of like last week about performance and stuff around preparing consistently for games, you know, because you'll know you can do anything on emotion. You can't do 40 games a season on emotion. You need to have something that you can fall back on, whether that's a structure, a process, a mentality, a mindset. And they say where focus goes, energy flows. And if you are tired, you're not playing well, you're not being selected, you're injured, how do you then switch on and perform for a game? And music was a tool that I sort of used for that. So when I first started, I had a notepad with three or four key points. I was listening to a curated playlist, and I was watching clips of me playing and highlights of people that I admired. I used to watch a lot of Richie McCaw play before I played because he was just incredible. I learned more watching him than I did ever from being coached. By the end of my career, I was watching like Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows. I was watching Dave Chappelle. In Australia, where everyone said sort of my best rugby I'd ever played, I was watching his stand-up series on Netflix because I was just chilled. I was ready. I didn't need that. I kind of was confident in myself. So it's amazing how things change.
Is that because by then you knew what your match day routine was and it was like you, to the point?
Yeah. I think I'd basically nailed the structure because lots of stuff goes on in your lives, but I had a good ability because I was always working on my mental health. You know, to be good at what you do, if you look at the best athletes in the world or people who have a good career, it's they revisit the things they need to work on and the blind spots and the bits every single day. So mental health is a watchword. And everyone diagnoses themselves now as, I've got depression, I've got ADHD, I've got anxiety, I've got all this stuff. Then you ask them what they're doing about it and they're not doing anything about it because they'd rather hide behind a diagnosis because they think by understanding what it is, they've somehow cured it. With me preparing for a game, I revisited that preparation all the time. So I would always go back to how I prepared for a game, what I ate. And that's the same thing with other areas of mental health. If I was dealing with criticism badly or other areas in my career that I wasn't dealing with very well, I was given tools by my therapist and I put them into practice. Excellence is not what people do these days in business and in life, where they buy a dream journal, they listen to a podcast, they feel super motivated, they go to take over the world and the next day they don't look at it again. And they maybe pick it up in 3 weeks. No, it's when you pick it up when you don't want to pick it up, you do it every single day of your life. And then you'll get better. And sometimes you won't know you're getting better. But that's kind of how I operate, really. It's weird. Whenever I talk about stuff, I think sometimes people use this word like authentic these days. And I I'm unapologetically myself in the way I do things. I'm not everyone's cup of tea. And the more I get to it, I was talking to my PA this morning in the car, and I haven't got any agents at the moment. And she went, why can't you get an agent? I went, because there isn't a lot of interest in a slightly aggressive former professional rugby player who's a bit of a white middle-class meathead, you know, who sometimes says the wrong thing at the wrong time. Not intentionally, but it can kind of happen. So I think self-awareness is always quite important.
I read that you stuck a note on your laptop at some point in time to remind yourself to not keep putting yourself down on podcasts.
Yes.
When was the last time you were completely satisfied with something you did?
I think what I learned through my career is, and only in analysis post, was that I was very much driven by wanting to prove other people wrong, certain level of negativity, either self-induced or trying to, you know, because people always talk about, you know, positive is really important. Actually, negative energy is really, really, I think, essential to any success, because most people will do things out of whether someone's told them they can't, they're jealous of somebody else, someone said, you know, something negative, there's been criticism, or they don't believe in themselves. So a lot of what I did was always trying to do, always trying to change that. So that was quite a thing. And I was never that satisfied when I played. So one day I was 17, starting out my career, or 16, next minute I was retired and 35. And I was like, did I really celebrate moments? Did I actually go and, you know, do the things that I should have done? Did I celebrate those? And actually, no, there was big moments and finals where I probably came off and I was thinking about missed tackles and missed breakdown opportunities and things I didn't do and playing with inside myself. So when I retired, I made a really concerted effort to celebrate little things. So when, for example, you know, I was scrolling through Instagram and I realized I was tagged in a video and Carl Cox had played one of my tracks and I didn't know about it. I was like, wow. And I sat there, I was like, you know, fair play, James. If you'd asked me all those years ago when I started, would that have achieved that? Would that have happened? You know, when you go and do an after dinner speech and they come back and feedback and you think to yourself, you know, I should celebrate this thing. So I do derive a lot of satisfaction. I think there are things that will drive you forward, which is your recipe for success, like being unsatisfied, like being hungry, like always being determined. But if you don't address your recipe for success, it's the same thing that can eat you alive. It's the same reason why billionaires keep working and working and working and working, never satisfied, never appreciating what they have. My therapist gave me a great analogy, because he works with lots of CEOs, that this guy was always on the road, always working. He had a housekeeper in one of his houses. And she was messaging him saying, thanks so much for letting me stay in your house. I'm in your infinity pool. I can't believe it. And he was in a hotel room, albeit a nice one, thinking, hold a minute, something's gone wrong here. I'm on the road. I need to rebalance what's important and be satisfied with what I got and not always work.
Going back to what you said there about your like playing days and being critical of yourself after a game that you've won, without doing that, you're not going to be the same player, though, are you? So you've got to be thinking, I should have done that better.
Yeah.
Always trying to improve yourself. And I don't think you get time to enjoy the wins because you're straight onto training, you're straight onto the next game. And now that you've retired from that, you're enjoying it. Life slows down a little bit and you can start enjoying yourself a little bit more with those.
Do you know what I do, though? Do you know what I would do with that? So, because I do agree with you, but what I would do now if I went back is I would go, I know the analysis is going to come. I know the criticism will come, the work-ons will come. With job's done now, why don't I sit and relax and just have appreciate, go, we won. Winning with your mates is the best thing in the world. Let's put our emotional baggage to one side, because you pick it up next day, and that's what I didn't do. Yeah. I would be on nights out and I would be, you know, I'd be sort of overanalyzing stuff. And so now what I do is, you know, when I felt my song was first played on radio, I stopped and got a bottle of champagne and I had it. And I was like, because that was a big moment. It's that balance, which if I could go back, I would try to compartmentalize my life even more than I do now and just go, all of it comes, the work comes. You thinking about it all the time is not making you better. Switching off, having a moment, celebrating the emotional side of it, because that's what I look back at sport really fondly about, was hanging around with the lads and was winning. Winning and being paid to be in shape is what I missed. What I loved. Everything else didn't matter. And also, for me, it was the bigger occasion. You know, I look back now and I went, people ask me, not knowing that I couldn't do it anyway because I'm not, my ankle's they were like, would you go back and play rugby now? I was like, no. Would you go on one of these like, old boys tours? No. Would you go and play in front of 1 million dog? No. I was attracted to playing in front of big crowds, big moments, big pressure. I love the game, but not that much to do it. My thing about rugby was I loved the fact that it was a linear pathway for success. You know, when you're in the real world, how do you gauge your success for now? How much money you got in the bank? How big your house is? In sport, it's very simple. You have a week. if you train hard, work well, work on your extras, you perform well on the weekend, you get another opportunity. And it's like that the whole time. And then if you take a dip down, it's fine. In normal life, how the f*** do you gauge where you're going? So I think for me, that's what I fell in love with. The instant feedback, the, if I work harder, I could get here. And here's a clear goal. In life now, with my music, is the most intangible, difficult, badly run set of businesses you've ever seen to try to gauge where success is. It's all out of your hands a lot of the time. It's down to image, it's down to call. So what is it you can control? In the sporting environment, there are lots of things you can control.
One of the nice things about doing this show is that Luke gets to see a lot of his old teammates and catch up with them. You've both represented England in different sports, but there's no manual for this is how you deal with retirement, right? So how have you both collectively gone about that?
I was quite relieved to walk away from football, if I was honest with you. Injuries took their toll on me, and for the last 2 years I barely played. So the day that it came that I could retire and get myself home, it was almost like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. I was training with the under 21s for 2 years at Queen's Park Rangers, going in, young lads looking at you like, you know, he's useless. Like, how did he play for England? How did he play for Villa and Tottenham and stuff like that? So it was quite easy for me, if I'm honest. I had a real slow petering out of my career. I didn't go from playing in front of 40, 50,000 one week to nothing. So mine was a gradual sort of way out the back door, if you like. So I felt like that made it a lot easier for me, because I felt retired already, even though officially I was still going in and training at a professional club. I felt like I was done.
I think for me, you know, retirement was an interesting one, because I still had ambitions to play for England. I'd always looked after myself physically, but towards the end, you know, I'd never really had proper injuries up until about 2017, when I ruptured all the ligaments in my big toe, my left foot, my plantar plate. That took 8 months to get back from. It was never that right. The only reason I was able to carry on was Under Armour sent me their NFL cleats that are much stiffer. You get 120 kg bloke on some of these boots that you can fold up like a piece of plastic. Like, there's no support there. So no wonder foot injuries, metatarsals all go, because you're pushing and scrumming in football boots, essentially, that were never designed for that. And so they sent me these boots, and they were half size or quarter size too small. And I thought, Muppets, put them on. It was like I had a new foot. I could not believe it. Eddie Jones was like running around going, Hess, mate, you're running around like a teenager, mate. And I was like, Eddie, this is amazing. So I sort of was able to carry on playing for a couple more years, but then my right ankle started to go, and then by the time I came up my ankle, my toe was so bad I couldn't run anymore. And so it was kind of backwards and forwards, and people were telling me I was old, even though I was physically fit, still doing
good
things.
What are you at this stage? 34?
Yeah, 34, 35 I was. And I think there's that analogy, isn't it? Never let the old man in. You know, people will tell you in your career what you should be doing all the time. You're this age, you should do this, you should be doing this by this. And it gets into your head, and it's nonsense. You know, age is but a number. You look at Tom Brady still carving up at 40. You know, look at these amazing athletes. It's the psychological part is so important, that if coaches were offering me pay cuts every single year for 10 years, well, you're really good this year, but you're getting older now. We're getting older. And I just kept defying it. And then towards the end, I wasn't able to defy it anymore. I wanted to go and play for England, again, in the World Cup. My last game was 2018, Six Nations against Ireland. And I played really well in that game, played well in the other games. Eddie didn't take me on tour. I was really gutted about not going on tour. I love Northampton, great club, but they absolutely wrecked me day one. You know, classic. I said to them, 35, I've trained, I'm fit, I work hard, you need to look after me, don't break me. First day, fitness test, weight, leg strength test, a session outside, run 15K, limped in, and everyone's like, oh, we probably should look after you a bit better. I was like, you reckon?
And you're not going to turn around I can't quite do this.
But
lads,
now I would just be like, no.
Yeah.
But almost through my career, the way I got through it was, because there's egos around all sports teams, and male ego is a real thing, I would always go and see other physios, other trainers, other strength coaches, other sprint coaches, right? And then people would get wind of it, and they'd come in, sit me down and go, you know, I don't know who you think you are, you know, we need to do this, you can't do it. And I go, yeah, no problem, I won't do it. I'll just go and do it anyway. I'd just hide it better. I'd always hide it better, because I would never take what people would give you as, you know, if you've got one career and one life, and I saw how I thought lots of it was disorganized and unprofessional. And I always gauge it as, if you look at the NFL and you're playing players 400 million over 5 years, all the training to keep that £400 million machine on the pitch is going to be really high end. Rugby, yeah, it's great, but it's still not like football level cash. You're still going to get rugby level talent. Obviously, there's exceptions to the rule. So when people are telling you this is why we're doing it, you're like questioning why. Well, we've always done it like that. That's not an answer, mate.
Yeah.
Why? And so I just found that there wasn't enough individual focus on people. So I always took care of it. So by the time I retired, I went one day from being James Haskell, 120 kgs, England player, to James Haskell. I probably hadn't really addressed any of the stuff that I needed to. And I started going back to therapy and talking about some of the identity stuff and, you know, the bits about the scariness of the future and, you know, what you're going to do with yourself. So I think I went through a real transition. I think it's very common, but I look at myself and go, I had a pretty good career. God knows what happens to those who didn't have a really good career. What do you do? And that really puts stuff in perspective again, that, you know, there's an analogy, isn't it? The guy in the guy in the bicycle wants a car, the guy in the car wants a Ferrari, the guy in a Ferrari wants a boat, the boat wants a private jet, the private jet wants a, you know, and it just goes on and on. It was the darkest 2 years or year and a half towards the end of my career where injuries were an issue. I couldn't perform. I was getting outperformed by younger players. You know, I was being told I was old. So my mentality wasn't great. And it's something I've had to go revisit again because I just turned 40.
You talked about ego there. I would love to know the difference between a football ego and a rugby ego.
I think you have to have an ego to be elite. You have to have a sense of, you know, I'm the man, I deserve to be here. If you don't, if you start doubting yourself, that's when, you know, your performance level can drop.
I agree with what you're saying to the point about the individual sportsman stuff in terms of you've got to have confidence in yourself, you've got to back yourself. The people who believe in themselves, whether they're outwardly vocal about it, you have to be selfish, you have to be determined. I'd say the big difference between football ego and rugby ego, in my opinion, and it's not an informed one, is in a football team, you can have a player earning more money than the coach, more than anyone, and be such a star. They have to be treated and are a commodity in itself. They can have a profound effect as an individual on the game. You don't have that in rugby. There isn't one player that is worth that amount of money that can have that effect on a team.
And is the gap not as big from the top?
Yeah, to So I think, you know, I've been in teams where probably the highest paid guy was $750 a year. Maybe there's a guy in Japan is on $1 million, right, with a year, which is nothing in comparison to football. But in the next drop off, you might have someone who's sitting around 400, 500. So it'll still be a bit of a goal.
Yeah.
But the point is, a Messi, a Ronaldo, a guys that they can single-handedly have an effect on a game. 15-man game of rugby, because of the nature of the stop-start nature of it, they can't really have that effect. A fly half can pull strings, he can control stuff, and they can have moments, but they can't single-handedly destroy a team. In rugby, there's a great leveler where the team comes first.
Mm.
If you act like a or your ego gets out of hand, more often than not, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. See, say a player diving in football and rolls around, that's always the cliche, rolls around, right? If a bloke in rugby did that, we'd come in Monday morning, we'd put a video on clip on the coach standing in front of the room, and he would play that video and go, what the are you doing? All the lads mug him off, like we'd all get into him. If he did a press conference post-game, then what do you think of James Haskell's diving? The coach would probably go, that's not something we have at this club. That's absolutely appalling. The stat, you know, we're going to have a long, hard look at him. And he'd throw me under the bus.
Whereas in football...
I didn't see it. I don't know what you're talking about. Because imagine you called out Ronaldo or called out one of the guys, you know, teammates you've had who was so precious you couldn't say anything because they were on pedestals. That would all fall apart. And so I think that's my only difference in ego, is because of the nature of the sport, the fact that it's a team sport played by individuals. You see it when guys score in football. They separate themselves from everyone, run off to get the adulation, might mug off a few lads. You'll never do that. In rugby, they run towards their mates, not away from their mates.
I do agree. And especially what you said there about diving. I cringe sometimes watching football now, and I often think, what would a rugby player think to that? Or they wouldn't even have known they got hit. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, and half the time, I'm thinking, if a rugby player had done that, he'd be vilified, he'd be out of the squad. Do you know what I mean?
Was there a hierarchy, though, when you were with England, Luke? Was there a hierarchy in terms of what James just touched on there with the players? Because you were coming from Charlton as well when you first...
Yeah, I felt so. When obviously coming from a smaller club in the Premier League, going away in the England squad. And I think Steven Gerrard spoke about it recently. I think they were all like such rivals in the Premier League trying to win it. The Man Uniteds, the Liverpools. They didn't gel or bond at all. So it was kind of like a very individual. They stick to their own sort of table with whatever club they played for. And if anything, I would say that was the biggest reason why they didn't go on to achieve, because there was no sort of camaraderie, no team spirit and no togetherness. And that would, they would probably agree with that.
In the England team, you know, you got, so I was really interesting. We were interviewing a guy, Finlay Calder, a Scottish legend. And he was talking about when the Lions got together after the Five Nations. Back in the day, Five Nations, there was no fourth official, there was no cameras. So first line out, if there's a young guy, you face me, they just punch him right in the face, stamp on the head, lay elbows, and there'd always be a bit of beef. You then take the team that have all that beef and then put them into a Lions thing. Most of the time, it's trying to manage that kind of, that rival and get people on board. Now, you don't have any of the biff, and it's very sanitised, so you might have competition, but you don't have that ag. You then go with a team where, you know, you get into that England environment. And if, say, the coaching staff is from a particular old club, which I had with England, you know, Leicester was a very dominant feature of what England did because they were so good at what they'd done. They were very tough training mentality. They won lots of things for a long period of time. And WAS, where I came from, were the polar opposites. We won stuff, but all of our values and the things we did couldn't have been any more different than Leicester. Leicester was all for one and one for all. They woke up in the morning, they went to breakfast together, lunch together. They were never apart. They sat in each other's room. They were like the Borg from Star Trek. They had one mind, and it was like they'd sit there, go beep, 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 and they'd all know what to do at the right time. They'd all answer, and they had like a spokesman, and they'd just all go around together, like a herd. WAS guys, we trained hard. We, you know, we pioneered this physical defence, so we were able to stick it to you. We were able to deal with it. You know, I mean, this famous thing was that Heineken Cup game where WAS went away to Leicester, got pumped 40-odd points or something like that. And the following week or 2 weeks later, we then played them back in the final and we did a job on them. You know, we were able to do that, but Leicester were consistently very successful, very tough club, and I've got the utmost respect for them. But their personality and people, if I'd gone to Leicester, they would have beaten me or and I don't know what kind of person I would have been. I think early days, I probably would have crumbled and not had the career I had. I was lucky I went to WAS with Lawrence Delalio, Joe Worsley, Simon Shaw, Fraser Water, Alex King. You know,
who taught you what?
I just think those guys did because they were no one was bigger than the game. And it was all train hard, work hard, play hard, stories, personality. You know, I got things wrong lots of times and I was like hammered, you know. And there was a moment where the lads, honestly, one of the lads came in and was like, you're right. They discovered that my dad had set up a website for me when I was very young, and I didn't know he'd done it. I didn't ask him to do it. And I played for England under 19s or 20s. He'd put a rose on there. He'd done this stuff because he saw it as, if you went to a sponsor and stuff back in the day, you could have offered them as a place to advertise. Quite clever. Now everyone had websites. So it was ahead of the game. Lots of things he did ahead of the game. You know, they say all the lads call me .com piece of and then there was a message board where you could interact and all the lads would be on there in the lunch break going, go yourself, Haskell, I hope you die, you like all the time. They pretend to be Warren Gatland. Gatland wants to see you, you're like all the time. So that was hard to take if you're sensitive. Like I was sensitive, a lot more sensitive when I was younger. I didn't really deal with criticism. I just wanted peace. I didn't want that kind of stuff. I really took criticism badly. That's what most of my therapy was about, was kind of lack of self-confidence, which doesn't necessarily marry up with what you see in front of you today, because I was always able to speak and have confidence to speak, but I really took things really to heart. People saying stuff. I once went on a chat forum after my first game with WAS, and it was the most traumatic thing. It was like a form of self-harm. Like I went on there, people were just awful. They'd turn up and play, and if Lawrence Delalio was captain, didn't do something, he'd get fined. People would get fined. No one was big in the game. They would set tone. Warren Gatland and Sean Edwards would come in and he'd call people out.
But is that constructive?
Yeah, I think, do you know what? I think there is a time and a place so the key to being a successful team, I think, is very clear vision on what you want to do and how you want to do it. I think understanding you've got a team of individuals and who can deal with that and who can't, but also understanding that sometimes it's good to throw someone else under the bus in front of the lads to show that you are, no one's bigger than the game. And it's got to be calculated, it's got to be considered, and it's the coaches that try to do smart mind games that don't do that, they get it wrong.
You're both parents. So if we take this as a parent, Luke, first of all, how would you go about a young early sports career, for example, with your kids?
Well, I'm quite, my boy plays football and I'm quite harsh with him, but honest. You know, we're an honest, we parent honestly, you know. So if he plays well, he'll get told, well done, mate. I thought that was, you was excellent today. If he doesn't play well, and it's quite obvious, I'll give him the honest feedback, but I won't do it in a negative way where he doesn't want to play again. When I was 19, I was playing for Spurs, and I think I got span in the box really late in the game. Striker threw me legs into the bottom corner. We lose 2-1 at White Hart Lane. So we go into the dressing room. It's all quiet. Like, nothing's been said. George Graham comes in. One thing. Luke, you've got to learn, son. Silence. And I'm 19. And I'm thinking, didn't want that to ever happen again to me. It was brilliant for me. So I was like, right, that cannot happen again. I can't have that situation happening to me ever again. And that's getting called out in front of everyone, but realising, right, I've got to raise my level here, and that can't happen.
I've thought a lot of it, because I've done so much therapy on so many different things, right? Your parenting is really interesting, because I look at my dad, and my dad, I think, was responsible a lot for why I was so self-conscious and insecure about stuff, because he was very critical about what I did, and making mistakes and bits and having an opinion. And like, I, as a kid, you just want to impress your dad. And even when I come off the field and I'd done really well, he'd go, yeah, I thought you did well, but you missed a couple of tackles. And it was always like that, right? Now, for some children, that'll work really well. Like, you know, you could take it on the chin. If someone coach done that to me at 19, like when I played my WASC debut at 18, it didn't go as well as I wanted to. And Rob Howley, the captain, actually threw me under the bus live on Sky, which is a bit unusual. All those kind of things happen. Now, that took me a long time to get over, because there wasn't any emotional intelligence in the coaching stuff. I love Sean. I love Warren. But alpha males, there wasn't anyone to put an arm around me and go, look, this is how we're going to help you do it. It was pressure from Sean, because he's a straight talking northerner. You know, they ultimately made me the amazing players I am, and I've got utmost respect. But when I look back at it now, what I would have done with you is call you out like that, that's fine. Next day, call and go, listen, I know how good you are. I know you don't normally do that. I think this is why you got caught. I want you to work with them. Let's do a few extras. Let's see how we can do it. It's not something to worry about again, because it's not going to happen again, but this is what we do. And I would help him. With my daughter, I think to myself, what was I really scared of? And that was making mistakes. So with my daughter, and again, I've seen loads of things about not letting kids win. I mean, she's three. So like, I don't, you know, trying to beat her or anything is a bit pointless. But as she got older, I probably would be as competitive as I could be with her to teach her the value of winning and push her as much as I can. I'm sure there's lots of things she will beat me at. So now you're just in that fun, trying lots of stuff phase. But the one thing I always think with her now, and if she ever makes mistakes or does something, is never criticise for mistakes, ever for doing anything. So, you know, but what I would say is, she'll fall over, don't worry about it, that's fine. What I've tried, look, have you tried it like this? And that's what I try to do, because I don't want her ever to be frightened to make mistakes. And I see rugby players and sports people are so intimidated by making mistakes, they play with inside themselves. She picked up a cocktail shaker thing, very middle class thing to have around, a cocktail shaker, and there was a glass in it. And as she's walking around, the thing fell out. And she went, sorry, daddy. I said, don't worry about it. And she went, I didn't, I said, Bodie, relax. It was a mistake. I'm never going to tell you off for mistakes. Don't worry about it. You didn't know. Don't worry about it. Play football. She runs, trips over on the ball. Sorry, Dad. That's Bodie. I don't care. You did well. You know, misses it next time. Have you tried this? And that's what I tried to do. So that's what I really want her to have, the fear of trying everything, never not making mistakes, and only being critical on the technique and process of what's doing it. You know, getting beaten by somebody or something because you were lazy or inaccurate. But the game would not flow unless people did make mistakes.
Is that through experience, the fact that you said you perhaps might have played within yourself? Were you scared to make a mistake?
100%.
And you could have been maybe more expressive, 100%. But didn't want to make a mistake? 100%.
I never forget this conversation I had with a mate of mine called Travis Allen. He's a Kiwi guy. So they instantly know more about rugby than anyone else, because they live and breathe it. And I remember he said, I'd love to sit with you and go through a game with you. And he was like, look, you look like you're just worried about making mistakes. You know, it's like you don't want to be in there, you don't want to take the risk of making mistakes, you're not looking for the ball, you're not playing with that confidence, you're just playing with inside yourself, you're getting tackled, you're not fighting. And so I got upset, and it was a bit awkward between us. Anyway, I said goodbye, and he messaged me, go, look, I'm just trying to help you. Anyway, I sat away and I reflected on it. I was like, do you know what, you're absolutely right. And it always comes back to something my dad taught me, is you can lie to everyone else, but you can't lie to yourself. And I was lying to everyone else. And I knew to myself that I was exactly what he said was right.
But you're so playing for England at this time.
I was playing for England at the time. And I sat down and went with him and I said, you know what? You're right. And there's twice it's happened in my career. When I was 17, first day with WASC, my dad sat me down and was like, James, you tackle too high. I know you're scared of it. You know you're scared of it. You don't want to do it. I was like, day, I don't want you to talk about it. It's like, if you don't learn to tackle, you're going to get exposed and you're going to get nowhere. So I then went to bed, had a row with him, and I sat in bed and I was like, he's right. Again, lie to everyone else. So I went into Wasps, day one, went up to Joe Worsley. He thought my name was Jonathan. He thought my dad's name. I was too scared to tell him it wasn't. So it went on for another 2 months. But I said to Joe, I can't tackle. I don't like it. You're the best tackler I've ever seen. Teach me. So every day, and it takes balls to run full pelt in some shins and knees, get booted in the face, get, you know, knocked out sometimes, all this kind of stuff. So I did it and I learned to do it and I learned to unlock that aggression that I had that would come out in other sides but just wouldn't in a normal phase. Fast forward 10 years, same thing. Went to this guy and said, you know what? You're right. My therapist at the time said, this is a great analogy, that when you see a final painting from an artist, right, you see the final masterpiece, you don't see all the preliminary sketches all scrumpled in the artist's bin in the studio. You just see the final work. All these mistakes and bits and pieces that you're so frightened to make or don't like or other people criticise are what makes you the person you are, the trial and error. So don't be frightened to do them. You've got to own them.
Now, you think it's a good time for me to ask the question, when you felt you was at your peak? Because a lot of your sort of accolades, man of the series in 2016 and obviously getting called up as a replacement for the Lions 2017 are sort of towards the sort of coming up to the age of 30, is it?
Yeah, I think that period's definitely the right up there. I think it coincided with Eddie Jones. I think when Eddie Jones took over, it coincided with my form, my mental, the place I was in mentally, and a coach finally respecting me, treating me like an adult, not being intimidated by the fact that I was going off and doing other things outside of sport that, you know, a lot of coaches would want me to, you know, I'd be entertaining the boys, I'd be up on the mic. They couldn't reconcile in their head how the same person that could be loud, bombastic, taking the would also be the first one out of the training field, the last one out of the training field, and work. Because in their world, it didn't synergize. Because particularly in the UK, we like our sports people to fit very neatly into boxes. Because that's how we digest our, and that's the way our media digest it. We want sports people with personality, not too much. We want them to be upset when they lose. We want them to be excited when they win. We don't want them to talk too much about themselves. Then you look at American sport, and they want they want craziness. They want personality, they want energy. Because over here, if you step outside the box and you lose, the first person, you want to spend less time worrying about that, more time on your game. Whereas Eddie Jones was like, he got myself, Dylan Hartley, two or three other lads, and realised that if they got us on board, you get the mob.
Because Eddie is a personality.
Yeah.
He picked you to play seven.
Yeah.
There was a speech, wasn't there, that he gave you?
Yeah, well I mean, I asked him, I went to Eddie and I just said, look, I love playing seven. I played seven for the Highlanders. I played seven in France. Not a lot of people knew. It wasn't really written about. So it wasn't unfamiliar. But again, the narrative from the fans and the people was, I didn't look like a number seven. I wasn't the same height as Neil Back, who was one of England's greatest ever sevens. You know, he was the blueprint of what seven should be like. I can't possibly be the right guy to do the job. So I just said to Eddie, you know, you put me seven. I'm desperate to play that. I love it. It's my favourite position. My hero, Rich McCaw, played it. I want to play that. And he was like, mate, don't worry about the media. They're no call, mate. All I need you to do is do what I tell you to do. Just run over the top of people, mate. Get the ball. And if you get a chance to steal it. But that's it, mate. Don't overthink it. Just do as you're told. And I went, yes, boss. And that was the end of it. And he goes, I'll handle the media.
You've played under many coaches with England. Can we start with Martin Johnson?
Martin Johnson. The World Cup camp, they just went barking mad. The first day we run 20K, they would have five sessions a day. They just went completely back to the old school, completely forgot what they were doing. I remember I walked in day one, looked at the thing, and I was like, five sessions. And I remember Graham Rowntree was like, if you don't want to be here, you can that. I went, whoa, I didn't say anything about that. I went, it's five sessions a day, and we've got 4 weeks, 5 weeks to the World Cup. Like, what? You know, we just come off the back of a season.
So this is why the 2011 World Cup, as you described, was an absolute shambles.
Yeah, that, and it basically went, it started there, and then it basically just went. I'll just give you an example. That World Cup camp was just an utter shambles. They, you know, it started badly when Nike, who'd given us all of our equipment, Nike had put way too many Nike ticks on everything. You had to have a certain amount for branding. So we were fined when we got there. We were fined for having Opera on our gum shield. We were fined. Eden Park had sponsored us, sent us to New Zealand freezing cold with no coats. I'd got Musto to supply a load of coats. They then got humped with me. One of the lads jumped off a ferry in Auckland. We, when we first landed in New Zealand, Nike thought it was a good idea for us to play in black shirts for our first game. as an alternative strip against Argentina because we couldn't wear white. They all got nicked at the airport. We then had to get more flown out by a night representative, and the numbers were stuck on a back by a local place, but they didn't do it properly. So during the game, it all fell off, and then everyone's going, why would you come to New Zealand and wear black shirts? The hotel food was utterly toilet. The lads landed in Sky City, and it's put in a casino. Three of them had lost their tour fee within the first 20 minutes of being there. I remember coming, opening the door, and a guy was carrying a in a towel because someone had in his sink. It was just utter chaos. But it was just utter chaos. But the weird thing was, it was like, you know, we trained hard, we did what needed to do, but I don't know why it just went from one nightmare to another
this
nightmare.
This is 2011.
2011. And we were described as the worst touring side in English sporting
history. I'm scared
history.
To ask about 2015 after hearing
that. Well, my World Cup experience is 2007, I got all the way to the final game and didn't get selected.
I went to the semi-final with that.
Oh, yeah, it was good. It was amazing, wasn't it? Then 2011, worst touring side. I actually played well, but obviously all the stuff with it, I basically was just so disillusioned with it. I got hung out to dry with the RFU, they mugged me off. I just was so sick of everything they'd done, trying to do stuff without us, wanting us just to put our hands up and accept the blame so the RFU weren't tainted. It was awful, right? It all kind of went on. And then I then left and went, actually, ironically signed for Stade Francais for a couple of years. And sort of left the country, and then everyone took part in this report about the team, and it all got leaked. Everyone threw everyone under the bus. It was like toxic. Everyone got fired. Then 2015 was an interesting one because it was our own home World Cup. I didn't really feature very well. I didn't really play apart from the last half a game or 10 minutes against Wales, and then a game against Uruguay. And we got knocked out of the pool stage of our own home World Cup. You know, the coaching staff, where they went wrong, they didn't have the emotional intelligence I've told you about. They talked about culture and bits and pieces, but there wasn't a real substance to that culture. It was all talked about culture, and it was manufactured. They got players in that were very vanilla, that were just teachers' pets, really, and didn't really stand up for themselves. Like, we'd have leadership meetings, and it was basically a meeting about what he was going to say. It wasn't really encouraged to speak.
The pool was tough, though, wasn't it?
Pool was tough, but what I'm saying is we were the fittest we've ever been, so all the stuff that was criticised against us, so that you cannot, when I fault the coaches, I look back at it now as an analysis point of view, I go, they didn't pick the right players, they didn't get the mentality right, but nobody could have worked harder, nobody could have tried any harder, it just wasn't the right makeup. So each of the coaches is a great man, a great coach. It's not criticism of that. It's just when it all came together with those group of players, with what happened in before, with the mentality, which is everything's very task focused. So there's no people focus. Because there's no people focus, it means that when the pressure came on, the wheels started to come off. We had a counsellor that I took to one side and said, listen, you've got to understand, lads aren't being treated right here. The atmosphere is not very good. The way the player coaches are speaking to some of us isn't great. And he goes, I've seen all that. And I said, what are you going to do about it? He goes, well, I just don't accept it. So I kind of told him as a senior player at the time, I said, look, you just got to see that. But even the therapist saw it. It wasn't addressed. So when the wheels came off, they came off in a big way. Then Eddie Jones comes in and transforms from where it was to 6 months later, Grand Slam winning run into whitewash of Australia, into World Cup final. And that was the best patch of England. He's by far and away the best man, best coach.
Best for me.
And like, best for me is not best for other people. But yeah. I remember the first week him in camp, eight of the senior players sat around a table like this and were like, oh my God, is this what international rugby should have been like? And I'd had 50 caps at that point, and I would have swapped every single one of them to have had more with him.
You've mentioned the therapy quite a lot there and the psychologist that was on tour.
But I'm absolutely fine, yeah.
How much different therapy have you tried, and why do you go back?
So I have, like everything, I keep quoting what my dad said, but he always told me to, that's why I said yesterday in this podcast, really, he always said, always embrace and maximise every opportunity. You never know where something's going to lead, you never know what's going to happen. With therapy, it came about because my godfather's wife, called Dr. Jill Owen, he said, listen, I think you should go and see her. I think it'd be really good. she's doing a lot of stuff for sports people. You might find it interesting. I was like, why do I need to go for a therapist? Like, well, nothing wrong with me. Then as I went through the process, it unlocked all the stuff around self-consciousness and stuff. My dad being critical and coaches being critical, and me being hard on myself and not dealing with stuff like that. And, you know, self-doubt and worried about mistakes. And that was underpinned it. But like I did with my, what WASP would give me a weights program, I'd go and see a speed specialist. I'd go and see a strength specialist. I'd go and see a different nutritionist. I'd go and see a different physio. I'd go and see acupuncturist. You've got to go out and try other stuff. So I've done hypnotherapy, brilliant, with a guy called Elliot Rowe. He used to record stuff I'd listened to before a game on a bus, 2 minutes going into a different breathe, like some breathing stuff, thinking about things. Visualization was massively important. We did hypnotherapy stuff where I talked to younger versions of myself, talked to my dad when I was younger, doing that kind of stuff. I've done mindfulness stuff. I've done loads and loads of things. If you told me now, like I've got a arthritis man, I've got to have surgery, I'd go and see a Reiki woman. I'd see a voodoo doctor if you told me it was going to help. So I always go and try these things once, see what they're like, go into open-minded. Is it going to work? You've got to find the right modality that works for you. And it might not be talking one. It might be Wim Hof stuff. Because that in a form is a form of therapy. Because we were having ice baths when I was 14, 15, you know, even younger than that. It's not new. But that combined with men being honest, with putting yourself in an extreme situation, dealing with the cold, dealing with your thoughts, expressing yourself, you know, the discipline routine. There's so much more than just an ice bath. The ice bath is the hook, but everything else is off the back of it. If that works, you're fine. If it's journaling, journaling is self therapy. You write down your feelings, you look at them, you reconcile them, go, oh, is that how I feel? For some people, they can't open up. It might be... you know, it might be going on a mindful retreat. It might be breathing, you know, if you're always intense. So I think it's the most incredible thing because the brain controls everything. Controls how you see yourself, how you see the world, how you sleep, how good a partner you are, how good you perform, how critical you are, your limitations, how you reconcile stuff, how you deal with emotion.
Luke, do you find it hard to open up? As a former footballer from that era, did what James just say, did you relate to that or not?
You just didn't open up because in the football world, if you opened up and showed a bit of weakness, the manager would look at you and probably think, do you know what, I'm not sure he's quite ready for the weekend. So it was just something that you didn't open up. You kind of dealt with it inside. You didn't talk really about anything. If he's going through a bad run of form, you'd keep it to yourself and you just work as hard as you can on the training pitch to put things right. But when I was playing, there weren't many players that would open up and there wasn't really that much access to psychologists and things like that. But I do think it's important now to gain those extra 1% that can make you a better athlete. If it works for you, then go and do it.
All the coaches that have come through that are coaching now and in charge didn't do any of that, didn't open up, well, have any of that kind of stuff. So they still don't believe in it. So they bring people in, but they always sit at the periphery because they don't believe in it. They say they believe in it, but they don't believe in it. And again, until as a man that hasn't opened up, until you do it and understand what that means, you can't experience the benefits. It's like when you go training and you start seeing results, you become addicted. If you give up before the results, you never get there. That's why I'm always, when people go New Year, New You, and they start running. Running is the most horrific, boring, hard, nightmarish thing to go and do. As soon as you talk to something, you feel better out of it and come out of it. And whatever, however it is you got there, and you go, it's when people get the first ice bath and they stop thinking about everything else that's going on, and their money troubles and their partner troubles, their relationship troubles, they do some breathing and they're suddenly present for 2 minutes. My transparency over talking to people, I sat down with coaches and thought, if I explain to them how I am, maybe they'll understand. So I remember talking to one of the England coaches. I said, listen, when you're really critical of me, it doesn't work for me. I'm not soft. But what I want you to do is go, you've done this and this well, this badly, this is how we're going to improve about it, show me how to help me do it. He just was like, oh, mate, I think you're overthinking it. And then he started coming up to me, like, you're right, you're just like, you're in your own head. And I was like,
what I'm saying about opening up, and then if you haven't got the right management around you, they look down on you and they're not really believing in it. And this is...
Yeah, okay. and that's what they had. And they do it all the time. Oh, you're a bit precious, you're a bit soft. It's like, no, if you don't know how you want to be communicated to, say in your partner or relationship or life, how anyone's supposed to figure it out? So until you sit down and go, how do I like information presented? If you don't tell that to people and coaches, how are they supposed to do it? And when you do open up, then they think you're mental.
This is where I think I struggle a little bit. I'm not quite sure your view on mental health, and particularly with men, because you talk so openly and honest about it and seeing a therapist. And I think you also have this view on diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of people out there look up to you
yeah.
and probably just want to level with you, yeah. especially when it comes to your yeah. ADHD, right? So how do you go about helping other people?
So my thing on my view on diagnosis is it's not a problem. I had ADHD since I was 8 years old, whatever it is. I never spoke about it, for not because I was ashamed of it, but it wasn't a thing. I've never met anyone for 20 years who'd had it. It didn't make any difference. I didn't want to share, like, it wasn't something I want to share with people, because it, knowing I had it was fine, but it's what you did after that. And diagnosis is often an excuse. Like, oh, he's a bit scatty, oh, he's a bit of a dickhead, oh, he's got ADHD, oh, he's forgetful, you know what he's like. It's like, no, you're using that as a crutch. Oh, I couldn't do that, I couldn't play. You know he can't play well because he's got ADHD. That's not a reason. I think diagnosis is not a problem and saying, I've got it, but it's like, what are you going to do about it? So I think the first thing is, if you've got concerns about how you are or something's going on, anxiety or depression, understand that more often than not, if you have got those things, and a lot of people have not got them, by the way, that when they tested a load of people who had depression, they only found out like a few of them, like 10% of the people who thought they had it, they were just exhibiting normal human emotions, which is some days you wake up not knowing why we're here, not wanting to be here, feeling depressed, feeling shit. Sometimes you have anxiety because you've got problems in your life. You don't want to stand in front of a group of people. You've got, you know, things going through your head. They're normal human emotions. Because we're now talking about it, we are now hiding behind what we should normally experience, which is, I come into a room and I do a podcast. I should feel a bit nervous because, you know, I know you, don't know you. What am I going to say? What's going on? Will people like me? Will the show be quite good? Normal emotions. I've got anxiety, just normal emotions. If I go out and the podcast gets criticized, people comment, oh, you know, I go into myself, I'm having a bad day. Have I got depression? No, I'm just dealing with human emotions. Depression is quite far that way. And say ADHD is quite far that way. In the middle is all the spatterings of normal human emotions. So I think firstly is understanding, do you have anything? And if you do, what is it? And if it is something, how do you treat it? And what should you do to go and then treat it? And then revisit that every day, because that might be, so when I had ADHD, they put on medication, I saw a therapist, and I worked very hard to learn to concentrate, to sit. My teachers knew about it, and they worked with me to help me do it. I don't have any other conditions. I've had people, I've been in relationships with anxiety. Anxiety doesn't ever go anywhere. So if it doesn't go anywhere, what's the difference when you have an episode? Is if you don't have any treatment and you just say you've got anxiety, then the episode could last infinitely to whatever point. If you have anxiety, you say you've got anxiety, but you're doing talking therapy, you're putting tools in place, you're doing whatever you do to treat anxiety, the time that takes you to get back on track will be shorter and shorter until you manage it. But you're always going to have anxiety. So you're always going to have an anxiety attack. If you've got depression and you're prone to suicide, you're going to have those thoughts. It's when you see it coming on and you suddenly feel like something's triggering you, what are the tools you've got in your arsenal to do it? If you just turn around and say, I've got depression, some days you feel great.
It's coping over curing.
It's coping over curing. And I think it's understanding. You'll never cure it, but you'll get tools on how to manage it. And I think with men in particular, there is this belief that bottling stuff up, not saying stuff, is like really brave and really tough. Look, if people in mindset, if they take their own lives, is in one aspect. But the not dealing with it and letting it explode is the weakest thing you can do. Hiding behind diagnosis and not working on it is the weakest thing you can do. The bravest thing you can do is going out there, finding out what you've got, and then spending that time working on it and managing it, and understanding that you can't fix it yourself, because if you would have fixed you would have done it. And there's no way you can grow out of it. There's no way you do it. Mindset might happen. You might find a partner that takes you out of that mindset. But when you break up with that partner, for example, you've plunged right back to where you started. And so I believe that you need to constantly in a process of working on that and understanding that your mental state changes. And there are times if you drink, wake up next day, you're awful. Things that will trigger you, relationships, work, stress. It's the tools you put in place that will manage all that. And so that's why. So I always say to young men, if I had a problem, like I was sitting down the other day, literally a week ago, and I was talking to people about, like I talked to you, how am I getting on? I was like, my dad's just died, getting divorced. That's not messy, but it's not ideal. Got a daughter. I'm working a lot, not making as much money as I want to make. I'm a bit stressed with being a dad and wanting to be there all the time, but also have to work. I'm traveling. I'm single, with everything that comes with that. I work very hard. I work late. I start early. How am I? So I called up my therapist, said, give me a session, sat on the phone, put it all out to him. But I gave him the truth. I didn't just go my version. I went, you know, this is happening here. This is what I've done. This is how I react to it. This is what I said. This is what happened. Because I gave him all the picture, both good and evil, right? And sometimes it's not nice to turn around and say all the stuff you've said and done, but you do it. And we just went through it. And I was like, I just checked in. I was like, am I dealing with this well? Because my dad passing away, you know, he's left an absolute show of finances and nightmares and court cases and that I knew was coming, but I'd spent so many years talking about it. I love my dad; he was a great dad, but I'm angry with him at the moment. But it's not like a misplaced anger. I feel like I told my dad I loved him every day, but that's a lot for someone to bear. Why are you getting divorced? Why are you in the public eye? Why, you know, while you're dating, while you're doing all this stuff, why you're tired? Why you're being a dad? Why you're traveling and DJing? Why having, like, it's all a chaotic thing. So I went and checked with him and I was like, look, I got some tools, I readdressed what I wanted to do, I got some new direction, I got a plan, I started putting that plan in place. That's what we're good. But I addressed it and I felt that was the right thing to do. A lot of people don't do that.
We're sorry to hear your news about
That's right.
your dad, and I saw it on social media when you posted about yeah. it. You wrote some nice words though. You said, I love you, Dad, I know you love me and I know you were proud of me.
Yeah.
You kept everything I ever did, framed it, treasured it, and I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Was there a reason behind those specific words?
No, I think it was more catharsis for myself to say it, because you know, that was probably the last time I cried over it when I wrote that post talking about it, because it was very very emotional to me, and I wanted to share it. I think we do live in a weird world now where if you don't post it, did it actually happen? And I don't know who the post was more to signify that I think for myself that he'd gone, to let other people know that he'd gone, because back in the day you wouldn't have ever put that out there. So it's really weird, isn't it? It's like you have a birthday party, if you don't celebrate and put it out there, does it even happen? So I was quite aware of that. I was like, this is a private thing, why am I doing this? But I was like, it was important that I wanted to say something to everybody about how I felt about my father, because I think as well, lots of times when people lose parents or family, they have lots of unaddressed things. My brother has a very different situation than my dad. They had a very clash, difficult relationship, difficult situation. He's taken it in a very hard way. I knew, again, because of the therapy and the preparation, that the way he lived, was the wheels were going to come off at some point and that he was going to pass away. I didn't think this early, but I thought about it a long time. I was talking to a girl, she said, you're very, I don't know what the word is, very considered, but I think about a lot of stuff before I do it. You know, I think about what the outcome is going to be before it even happens. I spend a lot of time doing that. That means I don't really switch off, so I never really relax, which is quite hard. But I knew with him that this was going to, it was going to happen. So because I preempted it, I thought to myself, every time I finish a phone call, I'll just say I love you. And he didn't used to say it back to start with. Not because he didn't love me, because he just wasn't that kind of bloke. Then he started to say that. Then he was very good at writing stuff. So he started to write more things to me about how much he loved me, how proud he was. We couldn't necessarily articulate it. But I looked at that and went, oh, that's his generation. That's his man. Again, it sounds like I'm a psycho because I'm always analysing all this stuff. But I did it with my mum. And I would go, you know, I came to the conclusion with my dad, he was never going to change. He was never going to go and work on himself. He was never going to go and talk therapy. So you have two choices in life. You've got a movable object that's never going to change. What do? I manage him. And I manage a lot of people in my life, a lot of people because who I know, I could have a row with you, but all this is going to blow it up, or just have a massive row. Or how do I do this? How do I see it? How do I not challenge? And that's, I think, really smart about reading kind of people's emotional intelligence and reading the way people are, is you can butt your head against a partner the whole time. And that's why I think some relationships that don't work is if you just learn to manage your partner. If you went, if I do this, you're going to get off. So maybe I won't do that. But a lot of partners do the same the whole time, expecting a different outcome. So what I did with my dad was I took away as much work stuff as I could from him, moved him out of the way. But I always kept saying, I've got one dad and there's things he did that I'm not pleased about. Financially put me under pressure, took money that he wasn't supposed to, did things, but I got one dad, I loved him, and he was responsible for lots of amazing things. And I knew that it would come to an end, and I saw so many other parents that were kids that were estranged from their parents. I didn't want to be that. So I made an active choice that he was not going to learn, he was never going to say sorry, he was never going to change because he believed that. So what was the best thing to do? I'd manage it, I'd deal with therapy, and I'd do it.
What was the closest sorry that you got to that kind of conversation with your dad?
I had him. Initially, before I was more considered, I had it out with him loads. And it just never got anywhere. It just blew up and we just never spoke about it again. Just got a blow up, massive rows, not wanting to talk. I didn't like it. I felt uncomfortable. We didn't get on. It made him really uncomfortable. And our relationship changed from me speaking to him every day to not speaking to him much. Not, again, just because the dynamic changed. Because I think I saw him as a hero. Then I saw his frailties. Then I saw some incompetencies of the way he was. Then I saw the fact that I think self-awareness and the ability to put your hand up and say you've got things wrong is important. And he didn't do that. And so that was hard for me. And because he exerted lots of control over my financial situation, bits which I find very difficult to have is controlling people in my life. I've gone the other way now. The more you try to control me, the more I'll just go the other way. And I think part of it was because of that. I sort of keep checking in because I'm okay with it. Like, not okay with it. I miss him. I keep going to call him and go, I want to tell you this of Dad, because he was a sounding board for me. And I like want to share this because he'll love this, you know. And I miss that part of it. But, you know, I don't want to say any more. Like, I don't, there's not unrequited like love. There's not like, I didn't know that he didn't love me. He gave me every opportunity. He made me the person I am. He pushed me to do things I never going to do before. So all that was important. And I knew that I knew the reason he was the way he was because he worked himself to the ground to fund me and my brother through our lives. And that in itself is a sacrifice. And he chose to turn up as a dad, came to every sports game, every match, watched me round the country, flew to every game, bought me everything I ever needed, bought me every kit. And like, that's all you can ever have. Now, he got things wrong, but that's when I did the funeral speech, was I said, when people die, when I die, right, say I die, walk down, I got run over a bus. You imagine someone on the news might say this hypothetically, oh, James Haskell, da, 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 you know, he was a lovely guy and this happened. They say all the best parts. Well, what you kind of want to go is, listen, James, he's a bit of a let's be honest, but he was a good guy and people who liked him, people who knew him, other people didn't. He courted controversy, but that's what made him the person him. And that's what I did with my dad at the funeral. I celebrated his good side and how amazing and care and like selfless he was and generous with his time and how much he helped. But did he look after his health? No. Did he just, you know, would he never take advice? Yeah. Would he always think he was right? Yeah. But that's what made him the man. And I think you have to celebrate those things. But if you understand people's blind spots, then you become much more powerful because you go, if I go into the blind spots, you know, unless they have a real epiphany or they go into therapy and work on it, they're never going to change. So what's the point, you know?
Thank you for sharing all of that.
That's right. And sorry, it's a bit of a lecture today.
No, it's not. It's
I'm a Weetabix.
I know you want to finish your line stuff. I've got one more on this and then I'll hand over because Steve Thompson and Lewis Moody are both 47. Steve diagnosed with early onset dementia. Yeah. Lewis has announced that he's been diagnosed with motor neuron disease. As a former rugby player, how do you react to that news?
Obviously devastating for both of them. I think with Lewis, you know, disease is such a cruel thing because it takes the best of us at times. It takes people that just don't deserve it. And, you know, Steve and Lewis do not deserve to have had these things. They were great team men, great players. I think it's important to talk about, you know, people talk as if Lewis isn't here anymore. He's still here. He's got a lot of life to live. He is an incredible bloke that will fight hard. He was one of the most determined athletes I've met. He had no off button ever. You know, he had either on or off. Even in like a semi-unopposed session, he'd take someone out. And I think, you know, I saw what his son put about him. He's an incredible dad. He's an incredible man. It's the outpouring of love. But he's still here. He's got a lot of fight. And I think what he will do is do great things for MND, keep getting that research. Because of all the diseases that are out there, and there are some horrific ones, this is a very, very cruel one. And like, unlike with cancers and bits and pieces, and else, you sort of know where it goes, but not really. With MND, you know what the end result is, and that makes it more terrifying and hard. But, you know, he will fight and fight like Ed Slater's fighting and raising awareness and being a great stalwart. And I think he will, like he did amazing things in rugby and became the Mad Dog and an inspiration, he will now go into that sector as an inspiration. And I think, you know, you've got to be there to support his family and for him and raise awareness. But, you know, all these diseases are horrific and everyone's got a story. And contextually, I can only talk about them, but, you know, there's some other, one of my mates called me up and goes, his dad's just been diagnosed with MND at 75. And that is a later stage one that's going to be even more aggressive.
I did just wonder if it ever came up for you as a worry.
Oh yeah. I mean, listen, again, because I thought that was my way again. I practice my tackling every day for 20 years, 25 years, maybe longer. I had lots of cerebral events. I was knocked out once cold. I had lots of cerebral events. I had a brain scan the other day. I mean, it was all right. I mean, there wasn't any alarming problems. I don't have any symptoms. if something happens to me, I've got no control over it. Really, there's nothing I can do. I can make better life choices. So one of the things you see: drinking, smoking, drug taking. Obviously, I mean, I took up MMA. It's probably not the sharpest thing I've ever done. You know, healthy eating, diet, all of those are contributing factors. But you know, with MND, again, I was looking at some studies. They're looking at maybe genetic, or they thought maybe genetic predisposition to having it potentially. That I've got no control over. Alzheimer's, early onset dementia, MND, again, I could get it. Cancer, I can't worry about it. But I have honestly, I live for today, always. Not, and that's not a flippant thing. It's the way my brain works. I woke up this morning, I was like, which James Haskell I've got today? I've got podcast in James Haskell, then I've got a DJ tonight. And then tomorrow, I've got a day off. And then Sunday, I'm coming back to be a dad. That's as far as I know. I haven't looked at next week. I haven't looked what I did yesterday. I've just gone and done it. And so that's kind of where I live. And I think if I was to go from one of these things or something was to happen to me, I've given it my best shot, really. There's not much more I could have made with the basic talent I've been given. I've lived life to the full. I've laughed. You know, I think of all the things I look at my life in comparison to other people, I laugh all the time. Sometimes at myself, mostly at other people. And I really relish and enjoy life. And I think there's lots of things when I retired that I thought I wanted, like a Ferrari, and I got a Ferrari and I watched it. I don't care. Good bed, good shower, good people, some good foods and good coffee, a bit of nice weather and laughing. That's all I need, really. And you can find that anywhere, really. You know what I mean? And so I think that's really where my ambition, and now with my daughter, all I want to do is make her happy and have the most fun with her. Like, you know, we were playing shops this morning. She was making me cocktails and driving me around her bike. And, you know, I wrap her up in a towel, spin her out of it like sausage rolls in the bed. So, you know, for me, those are the highlights and enjoyable bits, you know. And I'm trying to make a super soldier as well. I'm doing all these little games with her with like cones and bits, like running out in colours and things. And she thinks she's like balancing, thinks she's playing the game, but I'm trying to make a super soldier. Because why not? You know, if you can, why not?
And you had a good coffee today as well.
I had a great coffee day. Came and chatted to you guys, basically lectured you lads for 2 hours. It's been a perfect crime.
Lions is, I'm guessing, childhood dream for a rugby player. And when you was getting to the latter part of your career, did you perhaps feel when you weren't in the initial squad that it passed you by?
Yeah, I thought 100%. I thought that was it. I was gone. I was never going to be there. I was close. I was probably close at other times in my career. And then it always came down to the Six Nations before the Lions, and I just never played well enough. I played myself out of contention, really. And then, you know, I was gutted about that time. I thought that was me done, never going to get there. Obviously, Billy Vunipola, one of our good mates, he sadly got injured. Yeah, I was out in Leamington Spa at Zizi's, I think, having some lunch, living the real life. And I love Zizi's, actually. They wanted to give me a Zizi's card, and it was like, greatest thing I ever had. Right, literally, ZZ's, please go have one. I had a black Nando's card, I had all that for years. ZZ's card was next level. Pizza, calzone, salad, mate, it was game changer. Anyway, I was in ZZ's having a meal and got a call. Warren Gatlin calls me up. Hess, mate, it sounds like Eddie Jones' accent, but it's a different one. So, Hess, mate, are you fit? I went, yep. He goes, okay, speak to you later, put the phone down. My dad was like, who's that? I was like, I'm Warren Gatlin. I didn't even know he still had my number. Called me up an hour later, mate. Do you want to go on the Lions tour? I was like, yeah. He goes, you sure? I went, yeah. He goes, all right, I'll call you back.
Did you know you was on the replacement list?
Don't tell me anything.
Don't tell me your standby.
No one told me I was anywhere near. I just basically, I was in training. I was outside training on the pitch, came in. Lads like, you're not on the Lions. I didn't think I would be. That's how I first found. But anyway, 2 hours later, calls me up. Has want to take on the Lions. Billy Vunipola's out. Big opportunity for you. Come tomorrow to the England, or come tonight to the England, the Lions Hotel, get all your kit, good luck. And that was it. And then I was in, and then I sort of just absolutely embraced that. And the nicest feedback for me for all my career that I always value is my teammates and peers outside of the media have always spoken about me in the best possible way. So come on the podcast, a lot of them say, before I met James Haskell, wanted to punch me in the face. I met him, still want to punch him, but he's one of the best guys I've met. The Lions guys on the Living with Lions DVD, all of them to man said that I was a great team man, made a difference. And so for me, who cares what I write in the paper? Who cares what I write in social media? That's all I ever wanted. And that's what I kind of really pride myself on is having that. That's allowed me to go and work with all these different coaches, because on paper, would Martin Johnson and I get on? No. Would me and Di Young get on? No. But we get on with all these guys. They respected me and I was able to be picked and played. And that's, if you listen to what the media say, you'd never leave your house. Fans say you never leave your house. But if you're respected by your teammates and peers, that for me was why the Lions tour was so good. I was never going to play in the test side. I wanted to, I tried my hardest, but I had a really important role, midweek team, get the boys up. New Zealand is a boring place to go and tour. It's amazing, beautiful, hard work. Everyone lives and breathes rugby. There isn't loads to do. You need to have that entertainment. And that's what we did. And we got the tour back on track. We won games. We trained the house down. We turned up and gave the opposition competition. We got on the bus on the mic, making everyone have fun. We entertained the lads. People are missing their families and homes. That's your job. And you come off it and go, wow, what an experience. I made friends for life. I walked into the room the first day and I saw people's body language change. Like, oh God, it's like Haskell. By the end of it, I'd made friends for life with all these guys that I'd never met before. Rory Best, Alan Wynne-Jones, Johnny Sexton, Dan Bigger, you know, Stuart Hogg, all these guys that I'd never really had a chance to spend time with. Ian Henderson. Now, anywhere you go, it's like old times. You see him, and we're not natural bedfellows, but they were great. Sean O'Brien, sharing a room with him, you know, never, it's almost traumatic. We used to door open and try and talk to me.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, brilliant. Loved it.
We've got one of your books behind.
Yes.
So last thing, is there anything you'd like to, what's coming next for you?
Well, okay, so I've got a new track. A track came out last week called Rock the Rhythm with a lady called Dope Earth Alien, she's utterly brilliant. That's out now on Spotify. Search Haskell. Got a track coming out next month. I think we're my biggest today. It's called Sexy Back with a guy called Mossaman. That's coming out on 107 Music, and that's really cool. And then we've got a new book, GBR. I think it's like Reloaded or Unloaded. Reloaded, I'm going to say. They changed the title halfway through. So I think it's Good Bad Rugby Reloaded. All the stories, the podcast, the fun. Talks about Mike's career. Talks about what I've said today. Some of the stuff around my father and kind of everyone else is, you know, they haven't told their stories. I've told every story. I've written 8 books. I've told every story there is ever. But here's some more calamities.
Well, we've got one more question we ask every guest. Yeah. So when you hear the name James Haskell, what do you think?
Loud, funny, multi-talented.
You've been brilliant.
Thank you.
I love talking to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Who do I invoice?
Luke.
I'll bet you do that. As you cash. Oh, football cash. Yeah. Football cash.
Thanks, James.
No, but my pleasure. Thanks, lads. Good luck with it all.
You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube. Get in touch with us by emailing morethananamepod@gmail.com and follow along on socials for more content at morethananamepod.